Can you hear me today? How are we doing on that? Good afternoon, everyone. History for A, the Western world. I'm trying to get my slides up. I seem to be talking loudly enough today. And I'm going to make a few announcements while I am attempting to make the visuals work. My GSIs inform me that the exams are nearly complete. They will be giving them back in lecture on Wednesday. But that really means I don't have a chance to take a look at them. But I think that they're going to be pretty good. We've been talking about the exams in general. So I don't think it's going to be a very big problem. The GSIs tell me that they were overall pretty good. But they are concerned. My GSIs have also been expressing some concerns about many of you and about the sections and fundamentally about how much reading you're doing. They're very concerned that you're not doing the reading, specifically that you are not reading the textbooks, either Freeman or Gates. Now, you can be truthful with me. How many people have read about the Romans at this point? Okay, about half of you in this room, and at least half of you are not physically in the room. So, you know, that's a problem, because although we have made the sections, we've made the sections mandatory, we haven't made the lecture mandatory, and I'm not going to go through the hassle of taking the attendance every time I lecture, but I think that I may very well do something in lecture on Wednesday besides giving you back your midterms, that maybe reading up on Freeman will be very helpful. Hint, hint, everybody. I would suggest that you do some reading. So I think we're not going to cover quite as much about the Romans today as I might have liked, because I'm concerned that you haven't done the reading. Could my light people help me out here so that everyone can see? I'm going to talk about urban planning. I'm going to talk about the world. You know, actually, if we could turn the lights that are blaring on the slide directly off and then turn the lights that are in front of you on, that would be kind of a good thing. So we're almost there. I'm just going to keep talking. I'm going to try and orient you as to the physical world which the Romans are going to encounter, the physical world which evolves following the death of Alexander and the fantastic inheritance of money which the successors managed to pry out of the coffers of the Achaemenids. Okay, so everybody's got a lot of money. The successor kings have been very successful in setting up their various potentates. We have the Seleucids in Syria. We have the Antigonids in Macedonia and in Greece. We have the Ptolemies in Egypt, and we have some other minor successor kingdoms, the Attalids, who are in Asia Minor, a relatively small but extremely wealthy successor kingdom. And they put together, they build, they center themselves upon a city called Pergamum. And I'm showing you the plan, which is in your textbook for Gates. How many people have been reading up on Gates? Fascinating, fascinating reading about the ancient city. And Pergamon figures pretty strongly. Pergamon is a spectacular site you really ought to visit when you go to Turkey. How many people have been to Turkey? One person. And you got off the cruise ship in Ephesus, you said? What else did you see?
Nothing.
Nothing. Well, then you should go back, because it is a fantastically rich and beautiful country, and the people are extremely hospitable. Anyway, when you go to Pergamon, you see this spectacular site. Okay, very nice flat map. Isn't this great? Well, here's what it really looks like in the springtime. Perched on this incredible hill overlooking a river and lake, just a simply fantastic sight, especially in the spring. All right, what does that look like to you? Can you see? It's a theater. That is an extraordinarily precipitous sort of theater. I don't know how the people, that, I mean, Memorial Stadium has nothing on the theater at Pergamon. And we've got some really fantastic ruins. Pergamon was willed to the Roman people when Rome was climbing the heights of social and political ascendancy. And so it became an important Roman city, and we're going to come back to it as we go through the history of the Romans. But it was also an important Hellenistic city, and I'm going to show you a few of its buildings and monuments so you get some idea of what the successor kings were doing in terms of social projection using architecture and using urban planning. Okay, here is a model of Pergamon. And you can see it's built on this incredible series of terraces. And you go up the hill. Here's where the theater would be. Okay, that we were looking at. So we were looking at it from over here, and now we're looking at it from a different angle in this reconstruction. A series of courtyards and buildings and stoas. A stoa is a colonnade, basically a covered colonnade where you can get out of the rain or the sun, where you can meet and talk about philosophy. Therefore, we get the Stoic philosophers. All right, you can conduct business, you can have shops and so forth. This is very much the standard architectural unit of the Greek world. And the Pergamenes were pretty good at it. The Pergamenes had various installations, various public installations, public benefactions that they used to sort of project their power. They built, I forgot my glasses today, so I'm going to have to just make sure I talk about all the things I want to talk about. Specifically, they built a fantastic, an amazing library, which is, of course, missing to us. And they built also an extraordinary altar to Zeus, known as the Great Altar of Pergamon. Okay, and there's another look at the theater. Okay, so here's a view of this Great Altar of Pergamon. It's built like the Greek letter pi here, with this set of stairs and this sort of ornamental facade here. I'll show you that in a minute. And there's a courtyard in the interior. Okay, so this is not your little tiny altar that we had in the sanctuaries that I talked about. Remember when I talked about how the Greek sanctuary basically only needed a place that was cut off, a temenos, a place that was holy, and maybe a little spot where you could sacrifice an animal or maybe have some offerings. Well, the Pergamenes felt that this was just not sufficient, that they needed a much more elaborate architectural articulation of this idea of sacrifice. And so they built this absolutely gigantic structure. And so the actual sacrifice would take place in the interior. It's got this monumental, extraordinary monumental facade. All right, this is what it looks like today. If you go to Pergamon, this is what you'll see. Kind of a letdown, huh? If you actually want to see the Great Altar of Pergamon, however, you can travel to Berlin, to the Pergamon Museum. Now, when I went to school, a very, very long time ago, Berlin was in East Germany, and it was very difficult to go, and very few people had actually been to see the Pergamon Museum. And then when I was in the early parts of my graduate career, I was East Germany became part of Germany, and Berlin was opened up, and I attended a couple of conferences here in the very early period of the opening of the East, and this was an extraordinary place. So it was put together in the 30s. It was reconstructed in the 30s, and it's got this, it's been completely reconstructed in terms of how it would have looked, and the sculpture that the Pergamenes put on this structure is quite different from the classicizing serene sort of look we had on the Parthenon, right? Now we have these incredible rippling muscles, grimacing faces, and agonized gestures swirling drapery, and so forth. We call this artistic style Baroque. Okay, sometimes you hear it, the word pronounced Baroque, Baroque. And you usually hear that word, how do you hear that word usually when you encounter it? You encounter it, one more time. French, music, right? Can you think of a Baroque composer? Bach. Okay. All right. So what does that remind you in terms of music? Kind of, what about it is? Embellished. Thank you. Very, very good. Well, of course, that's where we get this idea here, too. We have this extreme embellishment of drapery, of muscles, of expression, of position, and of subject matter. Okay, so the subject matter on the Great Altar of Pergamon is the battle between the gods and the giants, which is a subject that we also got in various other forms of classical sculpture. But here we see it not in terms of serenity, but in terms of the swirl and movement and violence of what must have been the scene. That's the conceptualization. Baroque, Hellenistic Baroque poetry is just as over the top. Everything is bigger than life during the Hellenistic period. Art, literature, architecture, the whole nine yards. All right, so this is a fantastic sort of city. What is your average Greek doing during the Hellenistic period in a sort of a not average, but a sort of a typical city? We're going to take a look at Priene. Priene, also in Asia Minor. Okay, so Priene, here's a plan. Again, there's an acropolis, and the town sort of slopes, is on the slope of the acropolis, and it comes downward. We have this downward sort of slope. Okay, we have a temple here. We have a set of walls to protect the city against various successor kings coming to try and take it over. So the city wall became largely not necessary as the successor kings really settled down and Priene came to be underneath a sort of a peace. It was a peaceful city. And so we have a temple of Athena here, who is the patron goddess of the city. We've got a theater up here along the slopes and various other shrines. But one of the most important structures at Priene is the Bouleterion. Okay, now how many people read about that in Gates? Anybody read about the Bouleterion at Priene in Gates? Because it's there with pictures, the whole nine yards. Okay, so what is a Bouleterion? Anybody want to guess what a Bouleterion is? What would you guess? No idea. Well, let's look at the structure together. All right? So, what shape is it? I got a plan here. What's the shape? It's a square. Okay. And what do you think these blocks are? Seats. Okay, so this is a place where people sit. Okay, so it's called a Bouleterion. So something called the boule probably hangs out here. Anybody remember what a boule is? An assembly. Okay, so basically this is an assembly house. This is the place where the assembly meets. Okay, and it seats about 640 people. So we therefore know how many people could attend the assembly. Anybody remember how many people are in the assembly in Athens? Is it 500? It's 500 in the assembly, and then the demos can be, right? Right, okay. So it's about comparable. All right, so you sit here. You have a rostra. You have an altar. And you can have this articulation of spots. You know, you have sections. So that would suggest, shall we say, that people sit in some kind of order, right? And what do you do in the Bouleterion? debate, right? So it's a place where people can debate and sort of listen to each other. Okay, so we have this articulation. We have this articulation of the political life, and yet the city of Priene, right, is under the successor kings. What's the point of having a boule if politically you're under the direction of a whole bunch of Hellenistic kings and they're telling you what to do? Just come on, think. The suggestion is that there's community spirit and engagement. Okay? I think you're on the right track. Yes.
Didn't you say that even when the kings come in, the polis still exists on a very local, small, regional level?
Thank you. Yes. We are quoting Freeman, paraphrasing Freeman. Thank you. You did the reading. And Freeman was saying that although the kings existed on a larger geopolitical level, the polis exists in terms of local politics. And so there is a turning in, right? This is how it's described in Freeman, that there's a kind of a turning in on the part of the citizens and a real focus on what's important for the individual, right? Okay. So that's Priene. This is a typical city. The other really kind of interesting thing about Priene is that it's laid out on this very regular grid, right? Although, in fact, it would work a lot better because of the slope of the hill if it had a bunch of switchbacks. So Priene is, in fact, quite sloping, and you have to go up and down all of these stairs, and it's not really wheelchair accessible or anything like that. But there is a very strong sort of intellectual idea about what a city should look like at this period. It should have these sorts of regular planning and straight streets. Okay, so we're going to look at one more sort of place here. We're going to look at Delos, the island of Delos. Okay. So can anyone remember Delos from a previous lecture? Anything that you've read about Delos? Yes. I hear the Delian League. Okay. So does anybody, and I'm sure you remember what Delos is. It's the center place of the treasury of the Delian League, which is headed up by the Athenians following the Persian War. Okay, so it's an island in the middle of the Cyclades. It's an extremely convenient place. It's been an important sanctuary since the 6th century, 8th century, 6th century, 5th century. Our friends, the Pisistratids, were particularly interested in Delos. All right, but its life didn't stop in the 5th century or even in the 4th century. In fact, it became a lot more exciting and had a lot more architecture added to it. It became a lot more affluent because it became involved in the slave trade. Right? It became the major market for the slave trade throughout the Mediterranean, and Rome especially was immensely interested in acquiring slaves. It was a big way station for slaves coming from the east going west and not so much west going east. Now, all of these slave traders, all of these rich folk who were doing business at Delos needed places to live and places to meet. And I'm going to talk about the articulation of the architecture here and the planning, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about Hellenistic art that we haven't really covered and its social role. Okay, so we've got these houses in Delos, magnificent houses of all kinds, and I'm having trouble with my slides, but we'll see what we can do. And they were very frequently decorated with columns, sculpture, and in particular, Delos is famous for its mosaics. This is a particularly famous example of Dionysus riding a panther from the House of the Masks. It almost certainly, its artistic school, the school that it comes from, is Egyptian. It comes out of Alexandria. They use tessera of glass and a four-color technique. We looked at another mosaic done in this same technique when we talked about Alexander the Great. Does anybody remember seeing that mosaic? Yes. Okay, I should have stuck a slide in there. Made with the same technique. So a very wealthy place, a place where you could get an itinerant artist to put this kind of high level of art, and it's a high level of social projection in terms of the person who commissioned this wanted everyone to know that he had good taste and he made a lot of money and that he had connections with the East, with Alexandria. All right, here we've got mosaics. Let's talk a little bit about sculpture. This is my friend, sometimes known as the Roman trader, and we talked about him in terms of the development of the male nude, right? So he's got this doryphorus body, this idealized, youthful body. He's got an old, balding kind of head here, and he's got his cloak. So he wants to project himself as being both a mature sort of man, almost certainly Roman, probably. He's got a kind of a brutal, naturalistic sort of portrait up here on this fantastically idealized body. And the idea is that we have an appropriation of the successor to the kouros, right? The person in the absolute flower of youth, the default setting for a man of nobility. But as we're going to get to this a little bit more fully, in the Roman period, the Romans like to project themselves as having seriousness. The word is gravitas, and we're going to come to that, that they were mature, that they were experienced, and that they were the kind of person that you could rely on. So we graft the gravitas sort of portrait onto the idealized male body. Okay, so I talked about the development of male art, of male nudity, and I promised you female nudity. Everybody remember me promising you female nudity? You don't remember me promising you? Well, I'm going to give it to you today. All right, we're going to talk about a house, the house of the Posidonists of Berytus. Okay, can anybody guess where Berytus is? Anyone want to take a guess? Asia Minor? I know. That was a good guess because that would have been a typical place. Berytus. What does it sound like? I think I heard it. Beirut, yes. Berytus is the classical name for Beirut. All right, so this is the house of an association of people who worship Poseidon, or the god of the sea, from Berytus, okay, from Beirut. And in fact, this is the synagogue, and this is the association of the Posidonius of Berytus. They're kind of close together, and they're very similar. They have this courtyard where people can meet, and a couple of other smaller rooms, and other areas, and dining rooms, and so forth. So this is a clubhouse where people can meet, do business, have dinners, and also put up monuments and shrines that are indicative of the, shall we say, tastes and styles and divinities that are typical of their home nation. So the merchants of Berytus are trading. They're living on the island of Delos. They're doing business with Romans and Greeks. They've established this clubhouse, but they've built the clubhouse in Greek style. And when we get a dedication in one of the shrines in this area, it takes a very interesting form. Now, I always show this slide. All right, so take a good look at this slide. Take a good look at this slide. We've got female nudity here. What is going on in this slide? Aphrodite. It's Aphrodite. She's going to hit the guy with the shoe. She's going to hit the guy with the shoe. And who is this guy? Is he a normal kind of guy? No, he's the god Pan. He's got a pair of horns here and cloven hooves. And Aphrodite's going to whack him with the slipper. And up here, what's this? her son Cupid. Okay, so we're doing it in Latin form. We could also give her her Greek name Aphrodite and her son Eros and the god Pan. Okay, so one Dionysius, the son of Zeno, the son of Theodorus of Berytus, who was a benefactor of this particular clubhouse of the Posidonius, he dedicated this statue on behalf of himself and of his children and to his ancestral gods. Okay, so we have to make a little bit of sense of this object and fit it into our cultural context. All right, we know that Dionysius, the son of Zeno, is from Beirut. That's not a typical Carthaginian or Phoenician name. It's not a Near Eastern name. So Dionysius has taken on a Greek name because he's living in a Greek world, right? All right, so how many of you have Chinese names? Anybody have a Chinese name and an English name? How many people? One, two, three. Okay. So it's customary in China, when you're visiting China, right, to have a Chinese name and an English name. And my daughter has a Chinese name. She goes to a Chinese school. When she's operating in the Chinese world, her name is Bao Kai Li. And when she's operating in San Francisco, her name is Claudia. Okay, because basically it's impossible to write her name in Chinese. You can't write Claudia. You need to have a regular Chinese name because it needs to be written in Chinese characters. And when people come over from China and they're operating in the United States, sometimes they transliterate their name and sometimes they completely change it to a name that is more typical. And that seems to be what Dionysius, the son of Zeno, the son of Theodorus of Berytus, did. Okay? He probably made some direct translations. The next thing he did was he dedicated a statue of Aphrodite. Okay? But to a certain extent, he's dedicated a statue of Aphrodite in the form of Ishtar, shall we say, in the form of the Near Eastern love goddess, okay? And he's amalgamated her to the Cnidian Aphrodite, which is the spot where we get the female nude starting to emerge, all right? So the people of Cnidus had their wonderful stories about them commissioning this statue from the artist Praxiteles, and he made two statues, one with clothes and one without. And one town rejected the one without clothes as being not suitable, and so the Cnidians snapped up Aphrodite because the ultimate worship for the goddess of love would be to be able to admire the beauty of her body, all right? And so we had this situation in which men take off their clothes to exercise, and male nude has become the default setting for people who are aspiring to this sort of noble, heroic ideal. We have that in the classical period. Okay, so late classical period, this starts to move on in terms of depictions of at least goddesses, all right? And as the Roman period continues, we're going to occasionally get Roman matrons who want their head, I should have brought you a slide, but I will later on. They want their head grafted onto the Cnidian Aphrodite. Okay? They don't look anything like the youthful Cnidian Aphrodite. I'll show you a slide next time when we get to the Flavian period. Okay, so the Cnidian Aphrodite, Cnidus is a town off the coast of Asia Minor. Typical, right? Okay? And the Cnidian Aphrodite was just immensely influential in terms of being an artwork. So, when Dionysius, the son of Zeno, wanted to commission this statue, he's thinking both in terms of what is a typical depiction of my home goddess, of Ishtar, or Astarte, and how can I amalgamate that together with what I know of Greek culture to create this sort of playful tableau in which Aphrodite is having a very nice time here with Pan, but she's not about to allow the bestiality of Pan to completely overcome her. It's a really very interesting piece, and I wanted to share it with you. I always share it whenever it's appropriate. I think the slipper slapper's kind of fun myself. All right, so let's deal with Rome. Okay, let's get started on dealing with Rome. Okay, so we've said that the Hellenistic city, or I should say that the Hellenistic city, is a phenomenon that starts and flourishes in the Eastern Mediterranean. But meanwhile, in the West, hoplite warfare has been under development, and it gave way to the Macedonian Empire, right? Okay, we've talked about all of that kind of stuff. Now, in the West, we're going to talk about here, a number of communities flourished during the period of Greek colonization, all right, in the 8th and the 7th centuries. And again, we have talked about this. We've talked about Ionian migrations in this direction, but we've also talked about quite a lot of migrations from Euboea and so forth here into southern Italy and in Sicily, and we talked about in the very late 5th century the Athenians attempting to meddle in the basically Greek politics of the island of Syracuse. We've talked about how people were interested in establishing these colonies not only for political reasons but to take advantage, right, of natural resources, of grain, of metals, and so forth. All right, so when these Greek colonists got to Italy, of course, they encountered people that were already living there. Right? They encountered the Etruscans, and they encountered the Latins. All right, the Etruscans and the Latins. Okay, so the Etruscans flourished, and then they go into a sort of cultural decline, while the Latins, of course, still influence us today, because the people of this little settlement on the banks of the Tiber, see it down here, right here, this little tiny settlement on the banks of the Tiber, it was just a little collection of mud huts, all right, in the Iron Age. It was just a little Iron Age village. But by the time we get to Priene, by the time we get to Alexandria, Rome has really developed. It's gotten on to, it's gone from this collection of mud huts into a strong military power. It's consolidated its power throughout Italy. It's heading on down the boot, and it's going to take up with the Carthaginians in North Africa. All right? Now, just before his death, Alexander the Great was said to have considered having a campaign in the West to conquer the Romans. That is, historians writing during the Roman period said that Alexander was contemplating such a campaign. And that's one of our historical problems in reconstructing Rome's early history. Right? Hindsight. Oral tradition and rhetoric were naturally the tools that were put to use by the ancient historians. On the other hand, to a certain extent, you know, we're in a reasonably good position for reconstructing Roman history. We have a lot of documentary evidence. We have inscriptions. We have coins. We have archaeological material, etc. We also have, I'm just going to give up on my slides. I'm just going to try and read here. Give up on them. We've got all these coins. We've got inscriptions. We've got archaeological material. And we also have fragments of historical sources that were written by Greek scholars who were living in South Italy and Sicily. All right? And we know quite a lot about the administrative systems of the early Romans, mainly because those Romans like to consider themselves to be conservative. just as we said that the Spartans considered themselves conservative, and they liked to stick to things that were in the Great Raetra, the Romans really liked to think of themselves as being conservative and as following much older patterns. All right? They liked to look back at precedent, to repeat it, to revive older customs, etc. So although we don't necessarily have contemporary information about, let's say, the 6th century, not as much as we would like the 6th century B.C., we have a lot of information about what people thought the 6th century was like, a lot of traditions, a lot of things that have been handed down. So, as I said, by the late 3rd and the early 2nd century B.C., while all the systems that we've just been talking about, the Hellenistic kingdoms, the successor kingdoms, and these fantastic cities, they were starting to fray a little under the pressure of keeping up their administrations, Rome is starting to burst upon the scene, all right? It's ready to fill the power vacuum. Just like the Assyrians came into the ascendancy after Hittites were contracting. And just like the Achaemenids took over from the Neo-Babylonians, and just like Alexander stepped up to take advantage of the Achaemenid weakness, okay? It's just that Rome turned out to be a lot better. Okay, I have a question. I'm told that my microphone slipped. Is that better? I apologize, podcasters. All right. So, we're still okay now? Has it slipped? All right. So, the Romans are just a lot better at this imperial sort of setup. All right. They had to begin somewhere. All right. And they begin in mud huts on the banks of the Tiber. All right. I do have a slide of that, of these kind of crazy mud huts. There we go. So they're hanging out in these sort of round mud things. We have the post holes in Rome showing the place where the Romans, the later Romans, said, you know, this is the house of Romulus. So they would keep this house of Romulus just like they would keep the Sanchez Adobe or Mission Dolores or whatever it was. Kids would go and take field trips to see the house of Romulus. It's really very much the same sort of idea. And we have these sorts of models of these crazy little mud huts. So they're living on their mud huts, hanging out in their mud huts along the banks of the Tiber. And we need to see these Romans and use them mentally with a certain amount of dispassionate pragmatism. We need to see them talking about their past with a certain amount of pragmatism. We can't just accept the stories that the Romans told about themselves and about their past without a certain amount of critical appraisal. Okay? But we should not dismiss it either as mere legend. Okay, so let's talk about some of those legends. For example, or let me ask you, which legends have you come up with in your reading? What are the legends about the origins of the Romans? Okay, I heard Romulus and Remus on the banks of the Tiber, yes? And the story of Aeneas. Okay, how many people are not familiar either with Romulus and Remus or Aeneas? Well, that's pretty good. Very, very few people are not familiar with Romulus and Remus and they're being found on the banks of the Tiber. Now, remember, in the first lecture, I said that we could take a look at history in a chronological sort of way, from a chronological perspective or from a theoretical perspective or from a thematic perspective. Okay? So the chronological perspective is the most fundamental to history. And I know most of you took the time to study for the midterm and you straightened out the chronology, okay? Some of you came to my office to see me. But here's the interesting thing about the chronological perspective, right? It's the most interesting thing about time. Each culture has to tell its own story and from its own sort of perspective, right? With its own chronological markers. So Americans think about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War or the Civil Rights Movement. Right? But in mainland China, the markers are different. So we talk about a dynasty, the Qing Dynasty, for example, or the Cultural Revolution, although those two sets of events are going on concurrently, right? The American Revolution and the Qing Dynasty, or the Cultural Revolution and the Civil Rights Movement. They're going on at the same time, but they are separate. Okay? So historians, theoretically, can stand back and look at that whole picture and create a balanced reconstruction. But for the people as individuals, all right, for the people experiencing the present in terms of their own past, you see what I mean? There are certain things that they have to have a selective memory about. All right? They have past accounts, and those past accounts have to fit in to their cultural framework. So we talked about how the Greeks in the 5th century had constructed their history and their identity in terms of the Ionians and the Dorians. All right? I know some of you know I tested you on that. Right? Remember the Ionians and the Dorians. So the different Greek poleis thought of themselves as either being Ionian or Dorian, and these categories were political as well as factual or traditional. The categories provided reasoning for doing certain things, and when they wrote their own histories, this viewpoint was evident. And modern scholars have to kind of step back and assess the actual historical narrative against other forms of evidence. And this is exactly the sort of thing we need to do when we take a look at Roman history. Okay? So let's just start there. For the Romans, right, at the same time that, let's start with Aeneas. Shall we start with the story of Aeneas? Can somebody tell me the story of Aeneas? Yes, thank you. He was a warrior in Troy. After the fall of Troy, he and his family and a lot of people came to Italy. Right. Okay. And this story is told in which important work of literature? The Aeneid. Okay. So would it surprise you that the Etruscans had stories about Aeneas? Yes. Thank you. Why would it surprise you? Okay, because they're not Greek. Who's not Greek? The Etruscans are not Greek. So why would they have a Greek story? How would they know it? Okay, so do you remember when Homer was writing, supposedly? Okay, so when is when are the Homeric epics written down? The 8th century. The 6th century. Okay, so they're written down in the 6th century, and they have a tradition, the very early 6th century, and they have a tradition going back 1,000 years. Right? Okay. So what's going on in Italy in the 8th and the 7th century when the oral tradition of Homer is floating around, and in very early 6th century when it's starting to be written down? What's going on in Italy? And I showed you a slide. Colonization. Okay. So basically and fundamentally, these various indigenous people came together with Greek colonists, and the stories came together in this sort of a mesh. Now, the traditional date for the foundation of Rome is 753 BC. That's the traditional date which the Romans worked back from. The traditional date for the fall of Troy is 1184, as the various scholars and historians of the Roman period and the Hellenistic period worked out. All right. So how do we reconcile, right, the foundation of Rome by Romulus and Remus when they were abandoned by the river? How do we reconcile that with the story of their ancestor Aeneas showing up around 1184? Does that seem like a long time to you? Yes, I see nodding. And in fact, it is a long time. And so it was very important for the Romans to kind of come up with some kind of way of reconciling this. And the mechanism for reconciling this was to look back at a list of Alban kings, right? A list of kings who had been living at Alba Longa, which is not very far from Rome, and to situate Aeneas as founding Alba Longa rather than Rome, okay? Having a series of kings who eventually result in the production of the princess Rhea Silvia, who is raped by the god Mars, which is another traditional story. We get this all to happen at the right time, around 753, 756. We get Rome founded at the right time, and then the sort of traditional chronologies start to work. Okay, so basically what we're seeing is how the Romans in the 2nd and the 1st century BC are seeing themselves in terms of the outside world after the fact. The Romans of the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st century are immensely powerful and very rich. Therefore, they should have exactly the same sort of ancestors as all those Hellenistic successor kings. If Alexander had Achilles, well, the Romans ought to have a hero too, somebody like Aeneas. And yet, the Alban kings existed. And we know from archaeology and from tradition that it's really very clear that Rome goes through a period of about 200 years in which they are ruled by Etruscan kings. All of these traditions seem to work together. But as we begin to read Freeman and as we begin to read Livy in your sections, you need to think seriously about why the Romans are choosing to highlight these particular stories about their very ancient history, what it means in terms of their social projection. Okay? So when we come back on Wednesday, I'm going to tell you a secret. I'm going to tell you a secret about Wednesday. We're going to have a quiz. Don't tell anybody who isn't here. Podcasters, keep it secret. And what do you think I'm going to quiz you on? Yeah, I really would like you to be able to respond to the major names and dates that are in Freeman about the Romans before I really go on, before I start talking about Tarquin, before I start talking about Hannibal, before I start talking about the Pyrrhic Wars, before the Macedonian Wars, before I really get into that, because it's a lot easier if I don't have to sort of yank it out of you and if I know that you have some background. Okay? So I will see you on Wednesday. We will give back your midterm. All right? Questions?